From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tom Friedman has frequently written about terrorism in the Middle East. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with him about terrorism hitting home. Friedman is a New York Times foreign affairs columnist and author of From Beirut to Jerusalem. Also today, concerns in the Muslim community that they are facing an anti-Muslim backlash because their faith is being misrepresented by terrorists. We'll talk with Imam Hassan Kazwini, religious leader of the Islamic Center of America in Detroit, and Asma Hassan, author of American Muslims, The New Generation. And we'll hear from religion scholar Karen Armstrong, author of Islam, A History. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tom Friedman, has written extensively about terrorism in the Middle East. Now he's writing about terrorism hitting home. Friedman is a foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times. He's based in Washington, D.C. He won Pulitzer Prizes for his reporting from Beirut and Jerusalem and is the author of From Beirut to Jerusalem. His latest book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, is about the globalization of economics, politics, and culture. In yesterday's column, Friedman wrote, "One need only visit some of the most popular Arabic websites and chat rooms to see that public opinion in the Arab world is split about 50-50 between those appalled by the terrorist attacks and those applauding it." We called Tom Friedman this morning and asked why he thinks so many people in the Arab world hate the United States.
It's a really complicated cocktail. For some, you know, there's no question it's been our long support for Israel, a democratic ally of the United States. For some, it is the frustration of living in basically authoritarian dictatorial states, the Saudi Arabias, the Egypts, where the regimes seem to be supported by the United States. For some, it's the Gulf War, the fact that we're starving and bombing Iraqis or the Iraqi regime, for good reason, I would say, but the way it's depicted in that part of the world. For some, Terry, it's the fact that these are societies which, in many cases, but not all, have really been failing at modernization. Egypt's per capita income today is the same as it was in 1950. That is a tremendous failure at modernization, and somebody has to be blamed. And if this happens in a post-colonial era where you are independent, then really in many ways the blame is your own, but people don't want to blame themselves. It's all of these things. It's envy. It's jealousy. It's just lashing out at somebody. I wish I could tell you exactly what produced it, but boy, it's there. And also what's happened over the last decade, you really have to remember. You know, you read, say, the Egyptian press, which is the most important Arab press. It is vitriolically anti-American and anti-Semitic. Basically what these regimes do, because you have deeply illegitimate regimes in a lot of these countries, so they kind of let the press let off steam and deflect the frustration that people have toward their regime onto external targets like the United States, like Israel. And that's not to say we've been perfect or that Israel has been perfect, but these regimes have not been perfect either, and they allow no criticism of their own behavior and actions. And so basically what they've done is taken the frustration of these societies that have been failing at development and modernization and directed it all in their press for decades now on the United States and Israel. Well, this is the mother's milk of a lot of these people. So is it any wonder that these people grew up with a very perverted notion of what the United States is and what it stands for? That's not to say, again, that we're perfect, but they grow up with no mixed picture of America whatsoever. They grew up with a very dark picture of America. And it's not surprising that it produces people at the extreme end who would do this, and not surprising that it produces a wider silent majority that would quietly applaud it.
You just got back from Jordan, and while you were there, one of the people you spoke to was King Abdullah, who you describe as one of America's real friends. He said to you, the terrorists actually want to provoke attacks on Arabs or Muslims in the United States, because if the American community start going after each other, then you destroy that special thing that America stands for. Can you elaborate on what he said or interpret
Sure.
what you think he meant by that?
Well, you know, one of the things that, underlying all the, people who don't like us in the Middle East are many people who do, many people who really admire and envy what America stands for in the best sense of the word and would like it for their own societies. They admire our freedom. They admire our naive optimism. They admire our belief that, you know, the future doesn't have to be buried by the past, and that tomorrow can be different and better from yesterday. Those are not abiding attitudes, you know, in a lot of their societies, and they admire that a lot. And they admire the fact that anyone can come here and make it, that Americans have ownership over their government, you know. And that's why so many of them have their kids here. And basically what King Abdullah is saying is that you have to understand that the bombing of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon was just stage one for the people who planned it. These people think strategically, and they see this as a series of dominoes they're trying to set falling. And what they're hoping is that in response to this attack on America, we will then lash out at the Muslim world indiscriminately and basically become the main recruiting officer for Osama bin Laden and a new generation of American-hating Muslim publics and Muslim fighters. And really what our friends in the region are saying is, Lord knows we understand your need to respond and to respond effectively and firmly, but please do it carefully and in a targeted surgical manner so that you don't become the recruiting officer of Osama bin Laden and don't put your friends in the region in a situation where their publics are so hostile to you, let alone these terrorist groups, that it becomes impossible to cooperate with you publicly and maybe even privately.
Well, did King Abdullah of Jordan share with you any of his concerns about what the aftermath of military strikes would be in his part of the world?
Definitely. I mean, he's very concerned that it will lead to a new wave of anti-Americanism and attacks on American businesses and embassies and maybe even individuals throughout the region. And, people like him are on shaky ground. They know how fragile public opinion is out there. They know that there is a significant portion of people out there for whom no act, Terry, of no level of depravity against America or American targets is too much. 5,000 Americans killed in the collapse of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. For a lot of people out there, significant portion of those populations is just nothing to be mourned. And these leaders understand that, they're urging us to be careful.
Let's look a little bit about what's happening in the Middle East now. Things had really escalated in the Middle East conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. I read in your paper, the New York Times, today that Arafat declared a ceasefire and even said he wanted to volunteer for the anti-terrorism effort. How do you interpret that?
Well, Arafat knows that, he's on shaky ground. Basically, he's been winking at, if not encouraging, Islamic suicide bombers against Israel for the last 6 months. So I think he wants to be on the right side of this coalition after having been on the wrong side of the anti-Saddam coalition, having sided with Saddam Hussein in the Gulf War. My feelings about what's going on in the Arab-Israeli theater, I was just in Israel, Terry, the following. There is no connection in my mind whatsoever between these suicide bombings of our World Trade Center and the Pentagon and the Arab-Israeli conflict. Think about it for a second. These bombings were planned a year ago. We know that at least a year ago. What was happening a year ago right now, Terry? What was happening a year ago right now was the Camp David peace process. The United States was involved at the very highest level in trying to bring about a solution to this conflict, just as this was being planned. These bombers aren't looking for a two-state solution in the Middle East. They're looking for a one-state, one-civilization solution in which there would be no Israel whatsoever and no America whatsoever in that part of the world. So let's be very, very clear about that.
Tom Friedman, in one of your recent columns, you quoted an Israeli columnist as saying that the terrorists, when they strike Israel, they hit the Sbarro pizza parlor and the shopping mall. They hit the yuppie Israel, not the yeshiva Israel. Can you talk about that a little bit, like what he meant by that and your understanding of that phenomenon?
Well, what he was really trying to say is that, these terrorists, what they hate as much, if not more, than Israel itself is, consumer, material, secular, Western civilization. So you have this odd phenomena of these suicide bombers, basically. They don't attack yeshivas. They don't attack. They've never set off a suicide bomb in a settlement. They attack, pizza parlors and discos, the very symbols of, Western, secular behavior and attitudes in the Middle East, that is what they are fighting. They are at war with American civilization at every level. To think that they really just want the border to be a little more to the east or west is absurd.
You've seen people in Israel living with this constant, maybe low-level fear that anything could happen at any minute. They know that there might be a bomb going off at any minute. I'm wondering what it's like. I mean, Americans are learning now what it's like to live with that fear. What have you noticed about what it's like to live with it for a long time?
Well, what I noticed first in Beirut, you know, there were two kind of people in Beirut. There were what I called thrivers, and there were survivors. I have a whole long section of this in Beirut to Jerusalem. And, you know, thrivers basically, well, survivors were people who took in too much information. That is, I'm in Beirut, I'm walking down the street, an Israeli F-15 is flying overhead. I say to myself, is it trying to bomb me? No. Fine. Then I'm going to go on and play tennis. Okay. In other words, thrivers are people who know what's going on around, but they don't take in too much information so that their life is paralyzed. Survivors were the people who take in so much information, who are thinking about every possible threat all the time, that they are paralyzed and basically couldn't leave their house. You know, most people in Lebanon learn to be thrivers. They learn to just sort of focus on what they wanted to do, to factor out the risks in their head as much as possible, to not take in too much information, and go about their daily life. At the same time, you know, I was walking down the street in Jerusalem the other day, and it was the day before the bombings in America. But on that day in Israel, a suicide bomber had blown up the train station in Nahariya. Another suicide bomber had set off a car bomb in a main intersection in the town of Beit Lid, and some Palestinian gunmen had shot up a bus in the Jordan Valley, killing an Israeli school teacher. This all happened in a period of about 3 hours on the morning of this day. So I went for a walk down this Jerusalem street, Jabotinsky Street, and I was walking by a house where an Israeli woman was standing on her balcony on her cell and was speaking on her cell phone very loudly in English. And I heard her say something like, everything's fine. Tell Dad I said hello. Did you have a nice Shabbos? Did you have a nice Sabbath? And I thought to myself, there's something very Israeli about that moment. That is to say, these people are used to living in this situation. All I could think of, think what happened today. And this lady was saying, you know, everything's fine. Did you have a nice Shabbos? You know, they are used to living in this situation. They aren't going anywhere. And, you know, the suicide bombings in Israel are really based on the notion that the Israelis are going to run from Lebanon, run from Israel the way they ran out of Lebanon. That is just not going to happen.
Tom Friedman is my guest, and he writes a not-bad column for the New York Times. He's also the author of From Beirut to Jerusalem and The Lexus and the Olive Tree. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Joining us on the telephone is Tom Friedman. He's a columnist for the New York Times. He's written extensively about the Middle East and about the global economy. His books include From Beirut to Jerusalem and The Lexus and the Olive Tree. You're very angry about the terrorist strikes against your country. Most Americans are very angry about it. But I think, on the other hand, most Americans have to figure out how to channel that anger in a way that isn't counterproductive.
No question.
Is that a real concern of yours?
Yeah, that's a real concern of mine, and that's what I've been trying to point out in the column. You know, look, you know, this is going to be a very, very different war. As I said in my first column, you know, we're not fighting another superpower. We're not even fighting another state. We're fighting what I call in Lexus and the Olive Tree, super empowered people. These are people basically who use the network society and the whole globalization system to turn it against itself. You know, Terry, one of the things I said in Lexus is all roads lead to Rome, and they were great roads. And when the Visigoths and the Vandals wanted to sack Rome, they came right up the roads. That's exactly what happened here. You know, these guys made their reservations, one group of them, on Travelocity. the most popular web travel site. Okay, they communicated over the web using a very sophisticated, you know, web encryption program that was made it very difficult to detect their communications. They used all the strengths and networks of the globalization system against the globalization system. So fighting them, okay, is very much a police action, not an army action. I mean, I don't know what we're going to do vis-a-vis Afghanistan, and we'll have to decide, you know, what is effective and what is useful against the state of Afghanistan for harboring these people. But in terms of actually fighting the terrorists themselves, it's something you have to do eye-to-eye, one-to-one, through very careful intelligence and police work. And, you know, that's a very different kind of war. And obviously we're going to have to take a whole new set of precautions. When I checked into my British Air flight in London, you know, coming home and went through one, you know, X-ray check and went through another, I mean, I told the British Air people, you can X-ray me till I glow in the dark, okay? That's just fine with me. I will be ready to put up with any rational security precaution. But at the same time, we have to be careful we don't imprison ourselves. I really hope they reopen Washington Reagan Airport. There is no perfect security. We have to take every rational precaution. But at the same time, we've got to learn how to fight this very different war, which requires intelligence, police work, and rooting out people one by one. There is no Osama bin Laden, 15 Park Avenue, Kabul, Afghanistan, that you can bomb or go into and close up and arrest. I wish there were, but it's not. It's a very different war against a super-empowered individual and group of individuals.
Tom Friedman, I've really been reading with great interest your columns in the New York Times. Let me read for you the sentence I really didn't like at all. You write, while this may have been the first major battle of World War III, I hate to hear that, it may be the last one that involves only conventional non-nuclear weapons. I really hated to hear that.
Yeah.
Like that sentence.
Right.
Why are you using such... Yeah, go ahead.
I really hated to write it, you know. But it just really struck me, you know, how easy it would have been for them to have had, you know, one nuclear mortar in a suitcase. One vial of germ, you know, some sort of chemical or germ bomb. It's just very frightening to me. I go back to where I start. You see, what's happened is, you know, we've moved to this world without walls. And, you know, I don't want to get people all frightened. I don't want to get myself frightened. But we have to understand that, you know, the more integrated we become, the more we're tied together, the less amount of dynamite it takes to create wider and wider havoc, basically, when we're all this integrated and tied together. And, when people will do what these guys did, it tells me they'll stop at nothing. I mean, to me, the most frightening thing about this incident is that, you know, every time I see the video clip of the plane slamming into the building, I realize that I feel like I'm seeing something extraterrestrial. I feel like I'm seeing something that I always assumed, even all the violence I've seen, that was beyond the capability and imagination of human beings, that only someone from Mars could have done that. And what is so scary about this event is that I now realize I inhabit a planet with these people. I could have been in the airport with them. We all could have been in the airport with them. It's why I don't blame the CIA and the FBI. I mean, I wish they would have found this out. And if there were real screw-ups, you know, people, you know, should be called to account. But the failure here, Terry, was not one of intelligence. It was of imagination. Who could have imagined this? You could have laid out all the data in front of the most, you know, sophisticated CIA analyst, and he would simply, it would have been almost inhuman for him to stand back and say, I see it. This group of people who have been living in this country amongst us for at least a year, some of whom are secular people, educated in our universities, with their families here, are going to hijack four planes with all their lives and all these civilians in them and slam them into the World Trade Center. I see it. Well, next time we will see it. But who could blame anyone for not being able to imagine that? And that's what's so frightening to me. I look at my girls, age 13 and 16, I go back to where I began, and I say, what kind of world are they going to grow up in? And I wish I had an easy answer for this. I don't, but we just got to fight it, you know, one by one right now and hope that the number of people who live, you know, on this frontier of our imagination and beyond are not that many, and that we can somehow defend ourselves against them.
Any final thoughts you'd like to leave us with?
My only final thought is, despite everything I've said, I really urge everyone to be a thriver, to learn, how to change the channel, not to be overwhelmed by information and anxiety. I'm taking my wife and kids to the baseball game on Friday night to see the Orioles play the Yankees because, I've only got one world and I only got one family, and I am not going to let these terrorists imprison me or my society. We have to fight them in the hills, in the valleys, on the mountains, in the airplanes. But the most important thing we can do is not imprison ourselves and to preserve the way of life that we have, which is precisely what they want to destroy.
Tom Friedman, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tom Friedman is foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times and author of From Beirut to Jerusalem and The Lexus and the Olive Tree, which is about the globalization of economics, politics, and culture. Our interview was recorded earlier today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. From the National Endowment for the Arts. And from Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at saabusa.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, concerns in America's Muslim community about an anti-Muslim backlash. We talk with Imam Hassan Kazwini, religious leader of the Islamic Center of America in Detroit, and Asma Hassan, a self-proclaimed Muslim feminist cowgirl who is the author of American Muslims, The New Generation. And we talk with religion scholar Karen Armstrong. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Although terrorists have said they are on a holy war against the United States and have used the Quran to justify their actions, many scholars and Islamic religious leaders agree that this is a profound misinterpretation of the Quran. We called Karen Armstrong, one of the world's leading religion scholars. She's the author of Islam, A Short History, as well as The History of God and The Battle for God, which is a history of fundamentalism. What's been going through your mind as you watch Islam being used as a rationale for terrorist attacks that have killed thousands of people?
Well, I'm completely heartbroken by it, sickened, devastated, and sad. I'm particularly sad because when I think of the Prophet Muhammad, his mission was precisely to stop this kind of killing. When he was living in the 7th century in Arabia, the whole of his society was caught up in an endless bloodbath. Nobody felt safe. And he was able to bring peace to that part of the world, and so that people could congregate together peacefully and begin the service of God. So that to watch this peace-loving ethic, and the word Islam is related to the word salam for peace, this is just an awful indication of the way we can take something that is good and healthy and somehow distort it. It's a very sad comment on human nature.
Is there anything that you can find in the Quran that justifies the acts of terror that we saw last week?
There are one or two ferocious passages, and one in particular which is quoted by the chief suspect, Osama bin Laden, which has to the effect that you must hunt out unbelievers wherever they are and kill them. But then, of course, we go on to say that God always forgives. These things are often quoted out of context. But there are no more of these ferocious passages in the Quran than there are in either the Jewish scriptures or the Christian scriptures. So basically, it's not really just that people read a verse from the Quran and rush out to implement it. The fundamentalists in the Sunni world, that the Sunni Islam being the chief form of Islam, of the majority, tend to follow a program that is based on the life of the Prophet Muhammad. They see Muhammad as leaving the godless society of his day, withdrawing from it, and then beginning a jihad, a holy war, to conquer that society and impose Islam by force. And so they say we must follow the same pattern. We must also withdraw into our camps or special enclaves or special concentrations of society. We must prepare ourselves, and then we must engage in an all-out jihad. Now, this is entirely to distort the meaning of the Prophet's own life, because the Prophet was fighting. He was fighting a desperate war of self-defense because his community was faced with the prospect of extermination. But he, at the very moment when he knew that he was no longer, that his community was no longer in danger of being killed, then he stopped all violence and it achieved the final conquest by a most ingenious form and brave and inspired form of a campaign of nonviolence. He put himself unarmed into the enemy hands and conquered Mecca, finally, without shedding a single drop of blood. The Quran makes it very clear that there must be no coercion in religion. So, of course, by following this program, by making it so aggressive, fundamentalists in Islam, like fundamentalists in other faiths, too, are distorting and perverting the originally pacific message of the religion.
How is Muhammad said to have brought peace through nonviolence?
He did it in an extraordinary way. The Muslims had been fighting with their backs to the wall, but then against the most powerful state, most powerful city in the Arabian Peninsula. But then suddenly Muhammad announced that he was going to go on the Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. At the time, he was living in Medina, some 250 miles to the north, and every year Arabs from all over the peninsula would gather in the holy city of Mecca to make the Hajj pilgrimage. And the essential thing about the Hajj is it must be peaceful. Nobody may carry arms. And so Muhammad and 1,000 of his Muslims went absolutely unarmed, wearing the pilgrim's dress, into the city of Mecca and said, now we are peaceful pilgrims. The Meccans could easily have killed them, but that would have been to violate the traditions of the Hajj. And so they sat down and they talked and they worked out a solution. And as a result of that, peace treaty made at the, in this, these extraordinary conditions, conditions that were considered very unpopular by the Muslims. They were yearning to fight, but Muhammad said, no, peace is the thing. Non-violence is the thing. The Meccans eventually opened their doors to him voluntarily. They realized that their policies were outdated.
Any final words you'd like to leave us with?
Yes, there's something I would like to share with people, and this may be too soon because we're still rocked with grief and horror. But I am naturally, as a theologian, I'm desperately concerned about the way religion has been abused in this, and somehow we've got to make sure that religion. That religious practice somehow makes this hideous event brings some kind of healing to the situation. And I've been thinking hard about it, about the events of the 11th of September and the spectacle of it. And I don't expect, this is a long process, and perhaps people could just store it away while they go through their grief, their anger, their rage, but to think about for later. It seems to me that this is a revelation. The word revelation means an unveiling, that a veil has been stripped away, and we now see a reality that we didn't see before. And we are now seeing our predicament in the world in an entirely new way. We're seeing that we are not in isolation from the rest of the world. We are one people. We cannot, in our privileged countries, cut ourselves off from the rest of the world. Shortly, just before this outrage, this hideous, evil atrocity, the main item in British news was our asylum seekers. People were making desperate attempts, night after night, to cross the Channel and come to Britain. And we were trying to keep them out. Suddenly we had a sense of Britain as a little privileged fortress trying to keep out these hordes that were clamoring to come in. And now we're beginning to see that we're not a fortress. We're not cut off from the rest of the world in our privilege. In some terrible way, the world will come to us.
Well, Karen Armstrong, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Karen Armstrong recorded from London. She's the author of several books about religion, including Islam, A Short History. Coming up, Imam Hassan Kazwini, religious leader of the Islamic Center of America in Detroit. This is Fresh Air. Imam Hassan Kazwini is one of the many religious leaders in the United States who don't want Osama bin Laden to represent what Islam stands for. Imam Kazwini is the religious leader of the Islamic Center of America in Detroit, which includes a mosque. What is your interpretation of jihad, and how does that compare to the interpretation that, say, bin Laden offers to his followers?
Well, we have to focus on the meaning of jihad. What does it mean? Jihad in the Islamic heritage simply means struggle within. I struggle with myself to make myself a better person, to fight against my deviant inclinations, to be a better individual in the society. That's what jihad originally means. Later on, it was used to refer to defensive war Islam had to go through. We know that Islam went through defensive war once it was established 14 centuries ago. When Prophet Muhammad declared Islam, there were many other people, many other countries and empires that did not like to see a new faith is arising. As Jesus was challenged by some people, Abraham was challenged, all other prophets were challenged, Muhammad was challenged by people. at his time, certain people, certain governments and parties and powers. Therefore, he had to go through a defensive war. And that war was holy for Muslims, since it requires that they would defend their religion, their faith, and their people. Now, some people are misusing this. Osama bin Laden is trying to say, now that I'm in war with America, defending me is like defending your faith, which is not true. Most people, the majority of Muslims, know that Osama bin Laden does not represent Islam. He is not even a scholar, and now he is using the word jihad. But I don't think people, masses in Muslim countries, will be fooled with his claim, with what he says. I don't think people would really think what he is doing is a holy war. It's a filthy war.
What are some of the passages you're turning to now in the Quran to help comprehend what has happened and to offer some kind of comfort or meaning in a time of tragedy?
Well, we believe that Quran is our holy text. You want to know something Islam believes in, go to the Holy Quran. Quran indicates that killing one innocent people, it's like killing the entire mankind. That's in chapter 5, verse 35.
What brought you to America?
Well, I was born in Iraq, and I have been deprived from my own country since over 30 years, since Saddam Hussein, that dictator, came to power. My family had to leave and live in exile for over 30 years. 15 members from my own family were imprisoned in Iraq by Saddam Hussein only because they are intellectually were opposing Saddam Hussein. So I had to leave my country since early childhood, and I went first to Iran, and then ultimately I came to America. America that provided me with a dignified life, a very respectful life. I love America because I believe that America gave me the kind of life I was looking for. I don't live in fear here in this country. I'm a citizen, and this is the beauty of America, that it brings people from all around the world, provides them with the kind of a dignified life.
Are there a lot of people in your mosque who are concerned that if the United States and its allies bombs countries who are perceived as harboring terrorists, that that these people will have family members in the countries they left behind who might be hurt?
Well, I have to be honest with you. I think my community is concerned about the safety of innocent people, regardless whether they have relatives there or not. And I think all of us should be concerned about the safety of people out there. If the government of the United States is going to seek justice and bring those who committed the crimes, to bring them to justice and to punish the perpetrators of the crimes in Washington and New York, that's fine with me. All I'm concerned is, once we go there to Afghanistan or to any other country, what does guarantee me that there would not be harm directed to innocent people? Look at Iraq now. We know that Saddam is a bad guy, and he is the main troublemaker in the region. But now it's been over 10 years that Iraqi people are suffering. We are imposing sanction on Iraqi people. And when there would be an attack in Iraq, mostly the innocent people are getting harmed. It is not Saddam. Saddam is okay. We have been fighting him with him over a decade, yet he is in power. Yet he is more stronger than ever. I am so afraid that if we launch a war against Afghanistan, I am afraid that Osama bin Laden will remain okay, and he will be able to find a shelter for himself. So the one who will pay the price will be the people of Afghanistan. So I am concerned about the safety of innocent people in Afghanistan or any other country that might be a target of our retaliatory operations.
Imam Kazwini, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Terry.
Imam Hassan Kazwini is the religious leader of the Islamic Center of America in Detroit. Coming up, Asma Hassan, author of American Muslims, The New Generation. This is Fresh Air. Asma Hassan is an American-born Muslim in her mid-20s who describes herself as a Muslim feminist cowgirl. She writes about the differences between her generation and her parents in her new book, American Muslims, The New Generation. Her parents are from Pakistan. Asma Hassan grew up in Colorado and studied at Wellesley College and New York University Law School. We called Asma Hassan earlier today at her home in Pueblo, Colorado. Asma Hassan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Have you, your family, or any of your friends had any trouble since the attacks, trouble stemming from stereotyping?
Well, actually, my uncle lives in L.A., and he owns several 7-Eleven stores. And he said that the day after, on Wednesday, that this man came in and was being very rowdy and sort of knocking things off the counter and or off the shelves, and then he finally jumped up on the counter and was asking if they were related to bin Laden and associated with him. And so finally they called the police, and the police came and took care of him. So fortunately we've been lucky. And to be totally honest, I mean, I really haven't been going out very much. So sort of keeping a low profile.
Is that intentional? Is that a result of last week's attacks and the aftermath?
Yes, it is intentional. I just think that, you know, I don't want to go out and, you know, I'm happy to talk on, you know, on this show and other, you know, radio shows, but I don't want to, you know, hurt anybody's feelings or, you know, be, you know, rubbing things in, or, you know, you don't know how your acts would be interpreted. I did go to a church service on Friday because I wanted to show solidarity and support, but in general, I've just been sort of staying home. I am going to go to New York this weekend for an event that was planned ahead of time, and I know that I'll be speaking about my book, and I know that it's been advertised, and I am, you know, a little scared, and I don't want to be naive about it, so I'm considering, you know, hiring some security. The people who are, you know, running the event say, oh, well, we don't expect any trouble, but my feeling is, you know, we didn't really expect any trouble last week, you know, and look what's happened. So, you know, I don't want to be, you know, stupid about these things and put myself in a situation where people who are reasonably upset and angry do unreasonable things.
You said that one of the reasons why you're staying home is that you don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. I didn't understand what you meant by that.
I don't want to, you know, be in a position like at the grocery store where I hear people complaining about, you know, what happened and that, you know, we should get rid of Muslims. And, you know, and I'll feel obligated because of who I am and the type of person I am to go out to them and say, well, you know, not all Muslims are like this. In fact, the majority of Muslims are not like this. They're not extremists. So, you know, I just saying hurting, I don't want to hurt their feelings is a nice way of saying I don't want to get into any kind of trouble. And also maybe they're just not ready to hear that. Maybe everything's just too raw right now.
You consider yourself a feminist. Do you consider it a setback to Islam to have fundamentalist Muslims, and I don't know, a lot of people think fundamentalist isn't exactly the right word, but extremist Muslims who, like the Taliban, really deny women just about all rights and civil liberties.
Mm-hmm.
Do you consider that a setback for the Islamic world?
You know, I do in some ways, but, you know, the Taliban is so such a rogue government. I mean, it's not really recognized by anybody. It's not having that much influence on the Islamic world, especially not here in the United States. I subscribe to a school of thought that believes that the Quran is a living document and should be updated with the times. Most Arabs belong to a school that has a different view, in fact, a literalist view of the Quran, and that, you know, you don't update it with the times, you follow it strictly, as you can easily tell, whenever you're a strict interpretationist about something, it does cause a sort of harsh, extreme outcome, and that's one of the reasons why I'm really glad I'm an American Muslim, because being in America, I have the freedom to go to the Quran and interpret it from a fresh perspective. I don't have, you know, years of cultural baggage and patriarchy that is going to force me to do certain things without me meaningfully engaging with the Quran and deciding what do I want to do and what do I think the Quran is asking me to do.
It strikes me that you're in both a very difficult position and a very important position right now. You know, on the one hand, you're afraid that that there is going to be a backlash within America toward Muslims, and you see it as part of your job now to help explain what Islam is and especially what it means to an American Muslim such as yourself. You know, on the other hand, within the Islamic world, you see yourself as being a kind of modernizing force, a force that wants to bring feminism into Islam. And in that sense, you're kind of breaking with a lot of other Muslims.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a good way to put it. I am sort of caught between two different themes. You know, when I go to events that are mostly attended by non-Muslim Americans, people come up to me, and also people who have read my book have written to me and emailed me and said, you know, I learned so much, and, you know, your book, it just answered so many questions for me, everything that I, you know, wanted to ask about that I was scared to ask about or embarrassed. You know, it really addressed so many things for me, and I'm just so, you know, amazed that Islam is, you know, a normal religion, and it's not a bunch of, you know, it's not like the stereotypes, it's not a bunch of terrorists and women oppressors, and, you know, so they're very excited, you know, at the new knowledge that they've gained. And on the other hand, when I go to events where there are a lot of Muslims, there's always at least a couple very conservative Muslims who, you know, come to me and say, you know, you don't wear the cover, and that's wrong. You should wear the cover. And then they also say, you know, I don't like some of the things you said in your book, and you don't talk about the Quran enough in your book, and you don't talk about the Prophet enough, and, you know, this, you know, you really need to be more conservative. And, you know, and they're sort of, in a way, I get the feeling that, you know, maybe they're unhappy about me being sort of the, you know, this ambassador, you know, to Americans about Islam. I feel like I'm doing a lot of good, you know, and I think that those people who say that to me, you know, they don't realize how much misinformation there is out there and, you know, how much people don't know. I've grown up as an American Muslim. You know, I've been a Muslim all my life, and I've been American all my life, and I've met so many people who, you know, on planes, on buses, and, you know, and they'll say, you're Muslim? I mean, they're truly shocked, you know, when they meet me, and they're like, I don't believe that you're Muslim. You're not really, you know, Muslim. Like, I'm faking it or something, you know. So that, you know, that always seemed odd to me, and in my own head, in my own mind, I knew who I was and that it was okay to be American and Muslim at the same time, and in fact, it made a lot of sense. But you're totally right. You know, within the Muslim community, I'm a rebel. You know, I'm on sort of the fringe, and within the larger American community, I'm just one of those people who's saying, you know, this is my community, we're nice people, don't be mean to us, and I want to tell you who I am, you know. So on that end, I look sort of, you know, not rebellious, sort of, if anything, very, you know, much for tolerance and asking for people, you know, to understand me. I don't really seem like a rebel.
Your parents are from Pakistan. What are your concerns about how possible military action will affect Pakistan? I assume that they still have friends or family who are there?
Yes, we do have friends and family that are there, and actually they all have been calling us in the past week to say, you know, how are you? Are you okay? And many of them don't know that I moved from New York. They know that I live there, but they don't know that I recently moved. So they've been concerned about me, and then almost immediately after we tell them that I'm fine, then we say, are you okay? You know, is anything going on over there? And you know, and they say, well, you know, we think we're fine. You know, they're brave about it. They realize that they're in a precarious position. They think it's important to support the U.S., and they're shocked at what happened. But at the same time, they don't know how much their government and their country can withstand. They're a poor country, too. So as it is, they've been accommodating refugees from Afghanistan for years. And, you know, they're worried about how much they can withstand, and they're also worried about if the people of Pakistan don't support the President Musharraf supporting the United States, they're worried if there might be another, you know, coup or, you know, takeover by another military general who's more sympathetic to the Pakistani people who say, you know, we should not be supporting the U.S. So that's a concern as well.
Well, Asma Hassan, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed being on.
And I wish the best to you and your family. Thank you. Asma Hassan is the author of American Muslims, The New Generation. Our interview was recorded earlier today. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Dorothy Farabee, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Chasing the Hawk, Looking for My Father, Finding Myself, a memoir by Andrew Sheehan, from Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive, audiusa.com/pre-owned, and from Anchor Books, paperback publishers of Disobedience, the new novel by Jane Hamilton, author of A Map of the World and The Book of Ruth. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our examination of last week's terrorist attacks and their aftermath. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This is Neil Conan with NPR News. As new details continue to surface from the terrorist attack on the United States, NPR News will follow the story with special coverage throughout this week. Hear news updates and in-depth analysis from experts, eyewitnesses, and NPR reporters. Learn about the latest developments live. Please keep